My guest today is Melanie Jones, a former Australian cricketer and one of the best cricket commentators in the world. Mel has played 5 test matches and 61 one-day internationals and is part of the prestigious club of cricketers who scored a century on their test debut. While during her career, women's cricket wasn't professional, Mel has since become a strong advocate for women in professional cricket. As a commentator, Mel's worked for various sports channels, including Fox Sports, Australia, Sky, and BBC. Her vast experience from playing and a profound knowledge of every player make her commentary insightful and really engaging. She travels the globe, providing commentary on major tournaments, including the IPL and the World Cup. In addition to cricket, Mel has served as an ambassador and supporter of Red Dust, a non-profit organization that focuses on health initiatives in Australian Aboriginal communities. She's also a member of the Bowls Australia board. Mel's energy and passion for sports were so evident in our earlier conversation. And without further ado, let's learn about Mel's fascinating journey today. Hi, Mel. A very warm welcome to Atlanta Diaries. And thank you very much for partnering with me in this journey.
Emma, that is the most delightful introduction I've ever had. Thank you. I might write that down and pass it on as well. My mum will absolutely love it to begin with. We've connected through a mutual friend who I think we both agree in Prakash is one of the most divine individuals going around. So I'm so glad that he connected us as well. And before we get going too, and thank you for the opportunity of opening up from my side, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which I'm recording this podcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation here in the city known as Sydney to most people around the world. And I'd like to pay my respect to elders past and present and acknowledge any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who might be listening in today, but also any Native Americans who are listening in as well.
That is so beautiful, Mel. That says a lot about the amazing work you're doing otherwise.
Thank you so much. It's quite a tumultuous time in Australia at the moment, talking about our First Nations people. We've just had a referendum on the weekend to see if Australians would be up for acknowledging them in our constitution and giving them a voice to parliament, which from my perspective, unfortunately, didn't pass, but it has allowed us to, I think, be a little bit more braver in the stories and how we got to this place in Australia with our First Nations people and Australians as well. So hopefully it leapfrogs us forward into a better space in the future.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about that. I remember you mentioned last time in an earlier conversation about the referendum, but I'm also wondering that at least the good news is that thanks to the referendum, they've become, you know, front and center. People probably wouldn't have even known about them otherwise.
Yeah, I think for most countries that have been through colonization, so England, without getting into a history lesson on Australia, England went to a lot of countries 200, 250, 300 years ago. And we had a wonderfully rich and vibrant Indigenous community here when they first landed, and we still do. It's the longest living culture in the world. You know, they've been going for over 65,000 years. It is a beautiful history of people. And unfortunately, post the British landing, we went through a number of genocides. We've gone through a stolen generation of people and a white Australia policy. There's been some pretty horrific things that have transpired in our history. And in acknowledging that, hopefully we can reconcile the past so that we can sort of have a, I wouldn't say a blank canvas, but a canvas that we've got, you know, both sides, you know, sort of painting a newer picture and a more progressive picture of Australia.
It's a great history lesson, Mel. And what sort of inspired you to take up this as such an important part of your work, so to speak, after cricket?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I think my dad's from Trinidad in the West Indies, mm-hmm. and my mum is white Australian. So they met in England when my mum was working and travelling. She was a teacher. And I'd like to say it was a lovely little surprise packet that came along with that meeting. And so I was born in England, but I was only 3 months old when we landed back in Australia. When I came back to Australia, Australia was a very white city, particularly Melbourne, Nam, where I grew up. You know, you would hardly ever see another person of colour in the sort of 70s and 80s. I think a lot of people probably looked at me and thought I was Indigenous. Mm. So you sort of have this connected bond, I guess, of knowing that you're an outsider. People look at you as an outsider in a lot of ways. So I think that was probably the first part. The second part, I'm by nature a very curious person. So my dad, his connection to me was when I sort of saw him was giving me books, you know, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Maya Angelou when I was growing up. So I was always very interested in sort of the black side of history. So if I'm going to learn about all those cultures, I should be learning about Australia's as well. So did PE degree, but did a sort of a minor in health studies and did it on Indigenous health, and then was connected to Red Dust through that. And then it is such a beautiful culture and beautiful people that if I have the opportunity of getting to know it more and speak about it more, that's very excited to do so.
That puts so much in perspective. I'd love to hear more from you about your cricket journey and how did it begin, Mel?
Yeah, look, a West Indian dad and an Australian mum, most people would probably think that's the perfect mix for a cricket
Absolutely.
Journey. I wouldn't think that with the fact that my mum wasn't a sports person growing up by any stretch. But look, if you're an Aussie kid, you know, there's often a touch point of backyard cricket or cricket in the schoolyard. So I played all sports, basketball, athletics and the like. Sort of schoolyard breaks was always, in the summer, was always cricket. So I played with predominantly the boys back then. And then my grandparents' backyard in a very small country town called Rutherglen in Victoria. So I'd play with my cousins in the backyard, would make up all our own rules. And of course, you'd pick teams. And being my mum's side, all male cousins were white, so they were Australia and I was typically the West Indies. And that's the way you sort of connected. And the West Indian men's cricket team at the time was all powerful. So when they toured Australia, my dad knew a couple of them from his connections in cricket in England. So he would get them to give me tickets or sign magazines. So it was a point of connection for me to see these team touring that looked a lot more like me and they were winning. So what kid doesn't want a barrack for a team that's successful? And so that's how I started following cricket. The playing part was by sheer luck that I just went to two schools that had wonderful teachers that saw that I loved the game and got me involved from there.
Beautiful. It's almost like while your dad didn't see you for 16 years, but secretly he sort of planned your career.
He would love that. Back then, Australia to England, and it still is the world's longest journey almost. So his point of connection to me, his only child, was trying to find that point of connection. And so for him, it was wonderful that it was cricket because it was a sport that he absolutely loved and was very, very passionate about. And it was a nice touch point for him to sort of follow my journey, then playing club cricket to state in Australia as well. Sadly, he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was, yeah, a very proud father who loved the fact that we could engage in something like the sport of cricket.
Given that when you were growing up, women weren't in professional cricket, right? So how did you stay inspired?
Yeah, well, I think for one, when you have a natural love for a game like that, you then meet other people, very similar, like-minded people. And I met some amazing women and men, for that matter, who set a wonderful path for players like myself to come through and not have to deal with as many of the challenges as they did in the past. And I think that's probably inspired me to do the same for the next generation that's sort of coming behind me as well. I think cricket was a very male-dominated sport when I was certainly coming through. But it's also, in Australia, we've got a lot of football codes too, Australian rules football, but it's exceptionally combative. Those sports have probably struggled a little bit more in terms of that male-dominated space because of that combative nature. So I think for cricket, it was probably a little bit more softer for people to understand. So there's always been these wonderful points in the history of the game that women have been involved in and hopefully will be for many years to come too. Because I personally think it's a wonderful vehicle for social change. So if we're brave enough and want to see a better world, I think sport's a fantastic platform to be able to do that. So we've sort of got to drop that, you know, it's a us and them mentality sometimes just to sort of see the bigger picture.
In fact, how did you transfer your skills which you acquired in your cricket career, in your commentary or your other board positions?
Yeah. It's an interesting one because I know particularly within the sport of cricket, it's sort of a touch point. A lot of Commonwealth countries, but right across the subcontinent, so from Pakistan to India and Bangladesh through to South Africa and the likes, there are a variety of different cultures that play the sport, but a lot of those cultures still have a very strong piece on education for kids. And so that, you know, I'll often hear we don't want our daughter or son playing sport or playing cricket because it's going to take away from time spent in their educational setup. And I get that to a certain degree, but what I also think is that balance is probably one of the most important values and aspects of life. And if you can have a balance of being engaged in sport, what you learn from that sporting environment is a skill set that actually advances your ability, whether it's in the school education system, or in work, I look back on my sporting career, you think of things like teamwork and resilience and courage and communication, how you can communicate with them, how you can help elevate them, even though that you might clash for the majority of your times, the amount of teams I've played in where you don't get on with people, which is the work environment so many times. And all those skills that you don't realize at the time playing sport, you then are transferring into your relationships, whether it's at home or at school or in the workforce. And that's probably the piece of the puzzle. I mean, they say sport's healthy. The way I get up in the morning, I'm not too sure about that sometimes, but also all the health benefits as well, which we sort of know a little bit more about. But if I could say to parents that reducing their children's time in the sporting arena and sporting fields, just to think about those things, because they're lifelong skills that you'll use right throughout your work career or your social career.
You know, what struck me is when you said you don't get along with people, but yet you have to play with them.
Yeah.
Any anecdotes come to your mind when you had to make peace or make do with a difficult team player? And in the end, you sort of complimented each other. And did you resolve it? Did you address it? Or did you just ignore the person you didn't like? So I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah, would have loved to have ignored them, but you can't, because you're traveling with them, you're training with them, you're playing with them. And at the end of the day, you need to be able to step back. And so for me, whether it was I was playing club cricket or state or for Australia, particularly around Australian big tour events like World Cups or Ashes, is that there's a common goal,
right,
isn't there?
Right.
And that common goal is success. So if that's your common goal, to ignore someone in that piece of the puzzle means that you're not going to complete the puzzle. And all of a sudden you've got this wonderful picture, but the corner piece is gone, or the middle piece that's got the cup in it, or whatever, however you want to sort of phrase it, without paraphrasing Brené Brown too much. But you've got to lean into it, don't you?
Yeah.
You've got to find a way when you step into that arena, and they know that you've got your back and vice versa. And so for the sport like cricket, you know, I could be batting with someone who I don't particularly get on with at the other end, but I know equally I need them. I need them to understand my game and what I'm thinking. Now, at the end of the day, you can walk away and you hit the change rooms, and then you can go off to your own rooms and go have dinner with different people and all those sorts of things. But there needs to be a bravery for you to face that. Maybe understand a little bit of the why you don't connect, you clash, but there needs to be that bravery from the individuals, but also from the other teammates and coaches to understand where those clashes are as well, because they can also lean into that situation and assist at different times as well.
Mm.
So the best teams do that, whether it's unconsciously or consciously.
I love the word bravery. And of course, Brené Brown is my favorite. There's nothing like vulnerability, right? So I'm so glad you brought this up. Yeah. So any anecdotes come to your mind when you showed bravery?
Yeah. So Victoria and New South Wales, two states in Australia, are like the most populous, and they've got an arch rivalry. And we were coming into a state final, and it was the week leading into it. And Victoria had never really beaten New South Wales, so here's our opportunity. And a couple of the players came up to me, and they weren't senior players, but they were important to our success, and said to me, oh, look, Mel, we're having some issues with a couple of the senior players, and they're speaking to us. They felt as if they were getting excluded from decision makings and game plans, and felt as if they weren't an integral part of the finals campaign, which for me was quite sad, because we'd gone through the entire season and it got to that point where they felt it was bad enough that something needed to be said. And I can remember going to the senior players and saying, hey guys, look, we've got this situation bubbling away, and it's, you know, it's not a great one. There's a number of players that aren't feeling great and need to find a way to address this so that everyone can come into this final series clear of all that baggage and have a really fresh mind and a focus on the final. And here's my naivety. I just thought that the senior players would turn around and say, hey, thanks for addressing that. Let's get into that, work it out. And, you know, we've got a couple of days. And I was really, really surprised to hear that it came back on me as that I shouldn't have raised it. I should have just let sleeping dogs lie, and that I could have dealt with it myself and just allow everyone just to get on with it, and we can deal with it post the final. And because we're only a couple of days out from the final, I had then try and figure out the best way of then going back to these other players to say, and I wasn't certainly going to say, well, they don't think there's an issue, you know, so it was a tricky situation. I'd go to my source, my guru, my oracle, which is my mother. So I rang her up. I'm like, what am I going to do? You know? I spoke to another friend who's in the sport, but is in another state, just to try and bounce a few ideas off. And then, yeah, so I had to then go back to the players, and I sort of sat on the fence a little bit, but I sort of said, look, I've spoken to the senior players. They hear you, which they did, in the sense of I told them, so they've heard it, but I didn't exactly say that they've sort of shut the door on it all, and tried to be able to give an answer that they were happy enough with to say that they'd been heard. And basically that's what it was about. It was just about people knowing that they'd been heard and listened to. And so, you know, whether or not I did played that rightly or wrongly is probably another question, but things certainly did change the next season because the senior players had heard this situation. And yeah, so it was tricky. And it was one that, yeah, certainly sort of I utilize as an ability for teams to know the importance of being heard, but also acknowledging sort of those little moments where you go, that doesn't matter, when actually does it matter in the bigger scheme of things? Is there a thread of things that are weaving through that actually needs to be addressed?
Yeah, I love that. You know, and the fact that you brought your mom up, what kind of an influence did she have on you? What kind of a role did she play in your journey?
I mean, she's my guru, my oracle, my guiding light, I guess, in so many ways. And I think a lot of that comes from the person that she is. Mum came from a very small country town in Victoria. Look, back then, there wouldn't have been 1,000 people in it. And it was a very traditional family that she grew up in. My grandparents were gorgeous, gorgeous people. So my mum left and travelled to go overseas and had a relationship with a black man, had an illegitimate child who she was bringing back to Australia. And that shook a lot of our family and that sort of community, because that was just completely different. And my dad's family actually offered to raise me in England, where there was a larger black community. And my mum said, thanks, but no thanks. She's my daughter. So my mum, it was her bravery to bring me back to, as I mentioned before, you know, pretty white Australia back then, and raise me as a single mum in itself is just, you know, just an amazing feat. And, you know, my mum went through teaching. She became principal at schools. So she's just very even and grounded. I can remember tossing up whether or not to give up my job as a sports agent and go into cricket commentary. And my mum just said to me, she said, Mel, remember, the cemetery is full of irreplaceable people. So she was basically saying, just put your big girl pants on. You know, you leave, it's things aren't going to fall away just because you left the job. And so she's a very just even kind of person who knows me exceptionally well, which is thankfully, but just breaks things down into very simple bite-sized chunks so that you can sort of work through things. She's an absolute gem.
That's so beautiful. Talk to me about those transitions from club cricket to international cricket, but then from international cricket to giving up cricket and moving to becoming a commentator.
So, you know, as a cricketer, every Aussie cricketer basically grows up wanting to play cricket for Australia. I sort of had a lot of people around me saying that I had the ability, the skill set to be able to do it if I wanted. And then it was over to me as to the work ethic and everything that you sort of put in and around that. So there was a little bit more design about, you know, it was still a complete shock when I did get picked for Australia. I never thought it would actually transpire. And then you get dropped and you got to work your way back in and all those sorts of things. The cricket commentary was not something that I coveted at all. It was sheer chance. I knew that when I was playing cricket for Australia, you had to have a full-time job because you didn't get paid at all. So I worked in a variety of different roles, one that sort of hopefully gave me the flexibility to keep playing cricket and train and the likes, but two, with an idea that once cricket finished, you know, I needed to have a career ready to go on with. But the commentary side of things was I actually got dropped from the Australian women's cricket team on a tour of England back in the early 2000s. And I still, to this day, thank the selector for that, because I happened to be over there working with Surrey Cricket, and it was the first time that Sky Sports and the English Cricket Board were starting to broadcast women's cricket, and they needed a commentator. They needed someone who knew the players, and I just happened to be there. So I was the right place, right time. They asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said, no, I want to commentate on a game that I want to be playing in. Like, that would be just be painful and annoying. So I said, no. And they said, oh, you get paid £300. And I said, well, tell me where, when, and what to wear. Like, I was like blown away. 300 pounds was just like, I was getting paid more than both teams ever. So I did it to basically annoy all the players to say, well, I'm getting paid for today and you aren't, like, as a bit of a joke. And I can remember the day itself, I finished it and I said, I never want to do that again, because the men that were commentating felt as if commentating on a women's game was like punishment for them. And you could tell in their manner and the tone of voice, that was just an unenjoyable experience. I don't want to be in a room full of people who don't appreciate my sport and the efforts that the women have put in and don't give the same prep and build up and energy as to what they did in the men's game. So I just went, oh, well, I've tried it. There we go. And of course, I end up back in England next year playing cricket for Surrey, and another opportunity comes up and I'm like, well, 300 pounds would be too bad. So it just happened year by year. I was doing a couple of games. That was 2001. It wasn't until 2009 when the ICC took over women's cricket and had a World Cup that there was a block of seven games in Sydney where the World Cup was at. And then there was more and more opportunities. And then it got to the point where I had to make the decision between being the agent at the sports management company and doing commentary full time. So I, yeah, chatted to mum, bit the bullet, and off I went.
So what do you think was the deciding factor?
I would love to say that my values and altruistic lifestyles meant that it wasn't about the money, but yes, it was about the money. It pays a whole lot more than what my job was paying. And you've got to remember too, having never been paid to play cricket for Australia, we all finished our careers with what we call in Australia no superannuation. Our financial status was probably of someone who was, you know, 20 years of age leaving university rather than someone who'd been a work industry for 20 years kind of thing. So there was a stability piece and a financial piece about it, but it wasn't the main thing. A lot of the decision-making around that was a female voice in a basically still a very male-dominated area. There was the opportunity of hopefully being at the table in terms of, you know, a variety of different media and national boards to be able to voice the concerns or the wants or the desires of women in the sport and allow the people who had the decisions at that time to have a broader aspect of where the women's game was at and how it and the men's game probably can be better. There was conversations about language. Language is a very important piece to me, particularly within the media space, about how we can make it a little bit more gender neutral.
Yeah.
Having a female on comms certainly changed and opened up a lot of eyes. And, you know, that was quite confrontational to a lot of people who've been in men's cricket for so long. But the fact that I can get in there and talk to the piece about, we don't say batsman anymore because there are women in the game and women don't identify as men naturally. So we talk about the batter at the crease, and that still irks a lot of people in the cricket world. And so the ability to challenge that a little bit more to make sport more gender neutral was a wonderful little challenge for me as well. And I'm a traveler, so it meant I traveled the world. Like, I was living my dream in my place. It was a pretty easy decision to make.
You just said that you were barely paid as a cricketer. What does that mean?
It meant that I did not earn 1 cent being an Australian cricketer. Actually, 1997, we won our the first World Cup that I was involved in, and we won the final at Eden Gardens in Calcutta, at one of the most iconic grounds going around. And at the end of the game, we came up on stage, got the trophy, and then we got the big cardboard check. And we got so excited because that had never happened before and had all these zeros on it. And we're getting really excited. And then we forgot it was in rupees. So by the time we converted it to Australian dollars, I think we had enough to buy about six bottles of champagne and pay for some phone calls home and all that, and which we laugh about, but we still were facing a bill when we returned from that World Cup. And there was a publican in Bendigo, a small country town here in Australia. He heard about this and went, well, that's just ridiculous, and wiped the bill for us. I think he chipped in 40,000 Aussie dollars so that we didn't have to pay. So that was 97. 2005, we won our next World Cup, 50 over World Cup. And I got taxed on the prize money. So we didn't get paid to go over. We lost money for taking time off work and all that sort of stuff, but we did get prize money. And after tax, I think it was $385.78 or something along those lines. So that was the only amount of money I ever got paid to play for Australia.
Wow. And is that the same for men's cricket as well?
At the same time, no. So 97, we won. 98, the Aussie men won in England. And I think just the prize money then was, I think it was verging on 3 mil. They also had full-time Australian contracts. I mean, it's shifted exponentially in that time. I look at some, you know, Cricket Australia now chipped in the additional money required so that when the Australian women's team wins a World Cup, it is the same prize money as the Australian men's team. International events now is up to about 4 million for the women winning World Cup. So that's changed, and the contracts per country is shifting as well. And it's getting better and better all the time. It's still not to the same level as the men, but the world is changing.
So Mel, what then kept you going? That means it was just pure love for cricket?
Yeah. I was living the dream, and like, I've met some amazing people through this sport, men and women who I love dearly. And, you know, you love being in their presence because they challenge you daily. They see things, and cricket's a wonderful sport because it's a global sport that you have these fantastic conversations about life in Islamabad to life, you know, in Port of Spain, in Trinidad to Johannesburg. And you get to see the world a different way. That's a lovely place to be in. We've just had the FIFA Women's World Cup football here in Australia. I had this amazing lunch that just sort of happened out of nowhere with these fantastic women from America who I'm now working on a business projects with. And this would never have happened if I hadn't have played sport, and these business projects were primarily around the sporting world. But it's, at the end of the day, it's business. It's governance, it's leadership, it's marketing and media and high performance. So none of this would have happened if I hadn't stuck to enjoying the sport of cricket.
So that means the time when you were not playing international cricket, you had another parallel career back home in Australia?
So I tried to avoid full-time work for as much as I possibly could as a youngster. So I travelled a bit. So I would come home, I'd play cricket over the summer for my state, for Victoria, which is how you then get selected for Australia. And I would work with some regional cricket managers. So I travelled to country regions in Victoria and did cricket clinics in schools and, you know, sort of the PR of the game of cricket. And then over the winter time, I would go overseas and work with a variety of different organisations still in cricket. So I spent 3 winters in South Africa and did clinics in townships and spoke about cricket. Then I did the same with Surrey Cricket, which is a county in England. So I'd go into schools, I'd work in clubs to try and get them to understand how to engage young girls and women into the sport and the like. I then went into teaching for a year. Then I worked at Cricket Victoria for a bit and then left there because I always wanted to get in coaching, and that sort of door had closed a little bit. So then transitioned into working at Red Dust, setting up scholarships for Indigenous kids getting into media, and then got involved with sports management through a friend who had her own company for female athletes only. So, yeah, so I've done a variety of different things over the career, which, again, I think, what do they say? Jack of all trades, master of none. I think it's given me, you know, a couple of different touch points, which has helped me get to the place that I'm at the moment.
Yeah, the cricket game was the platform for you to do so many different things. So let's shift gears. Sounds like the real challenges, the real fun happened in your commentating career. I know you spoke earlier about the fact that even the jargon, it was almost like a blind spot for them, I guess.
Yeah, look, it was, I think having coming through playing the sport of cricket, and you know that there's barriers and hurdles and resistance to women in the sport there, it probably made it a little bit easier coming into the commentary box because you knew that you were probably going to come up against a few of those, whether it's from people within the commentary box or fans of the game through social media and the like. I do remember having my first IPL experience back in 2015, and there was 4 women on that series in the commentary box across 4 crews. So there was only ever 1 female per game. So Lisa Stelaker, another Australian cricketer, Isha Guha, an English cricketer, and Anjum Chopra, a former Indian captain, who are still all commentating now and are wonderful friends. And I can remember we all sort of rang each other and went, what are we getting ourselves into here? Because all of a sudden the men's game had to listen to a woman's voice. And for those that don't follow sport or are listening into the podcast, there is a big angst about particularly men who follow sport and having a woman commentate it because of the pitch and the tone. And a lot of women at the back end of sentences tend to inflect up, which makes it all higher. And it grates on a lot of guys because they're not used to it. They're used to a very sort of lower monotone voice, which I thank my mum and dad daily because I think I've got a slightly lower voice than a lot of women. And we need to brace ourselves here because this, we could be up for a lot of backlash from a variety of different angles. And I remember getting into the commentary box for my first stint, and it was in Chennai at a game there, and it was with two stalwarts of men's cricket commentary. And Chennai's hot anyways, but I was sweating bucket loads, I think with more through nerves than heat and humidity. And I can remember something happened in the play, the lead commentator called it, and I went for the microphone to put my 2 cents worth in, and so did the other expert commentator. We sort of both picked up our mics at the same time. And so automatically I just went to put it down as if to say to him, you go. And he looked at me and he put his microphone down and he gave me a gesture with his hand as if to, he pointed at me and he said, you go. And he just gave me a thumbs up. And it was just that little moment. The commentator's Mike Haseman, who was a former Australian cricketer, but has spent a lot of time in South Africa and the States. And it was just this almost relief, you know, I just sort of went, oh, okay. And so it just allowed you to say, hey, I'm part of the team, like a cricket team, but we're our own little crew here. And we spent the whole IPL together, this crew of commentators. We finished the game, got back to the hotel, and cricketers, they love a beer after a game. And it's India, I like a beer. So we all sort of got in, we had a few beers, and we all chatted about the game. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm one of the boys. I can remember thinking that phrase to myself. And at the time, I thought that was fantastic. Down the years down the track, I realized that's not exactly what you want to feel like, because it was, and how do I say this without, I want those guys to know that I love them dearly for doing what they did to allow me in. But I was sort of shape-shifting myself into their space. And these are the things you learn when you get older and wiser and grumpier, but I maneuvering myself into their space to fit their world. And if now when I'm commentating and allowing, not allowing, having new people in commentary box, I try to stop myself from getting them to move into the space that we're happy with. We need to be really, this is word, brave again, to know that sense of belonging doesn't come from us allowing them into our space, but us saying, how do we need to shift our commentary box or our piece so that everyone feels comfortable in their own space and just to front up being them. Now, if that's them not drinking beer after a game, let's offer a lovely chai or a sparkling water or something along those lines so that we're just being as welcoming as we possibly can without sort of shifting the enjoyment for everybody.
So for lack of a better expression, do you think it's almost like he did a favor to you?
You know what? I actually haven't spoken to him about it. I should pick up the phone and give him a call. I think there was probably a few pieces. I think he understood that I was nervous, and the best way of getting rid of nerves is just jumping in the deep end of the pool kind of thing. So the quicker he could get me in, the better for him and the better for the broadcast as well. I think there was certainly a piece around him also saying, yeah, the tide's shifting, like he was a person and, you know, I think you can commentate. So here's your opportunity to do that. Maybe he went to say something and maybe he thought, actually, that was a silly thing to say and I saved him. I don't know. You know, he just, you don't know what was going through his mind at that point in time. But I look, from my perspective and knowing Mike, I think he recognised that this was a shift in the cricket world and he wanted to support me in that moment. And I'm very, very thankful that he took that opportunity and took that moment. It was such a small gesture, but it resonated with me so, so much. Mm. That's all about allyship, isn't it?
Yes, and exactly. Yeah.
So, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges for men in a space where there's more and more women coming in is how do I be a good ally? And so often I hear the thing, oh, well, I've got daughters. So it shouldn't take you having daughters or having a wife or a mum to know that that's the right thing to do. So that allyship is just recognizing moments where you can step in and not only recognizing them, but actioning it as well and not being fearful of backlash from other men or from, you know, from other groups and just saying, no, I'm going to hold my space so that I can allow this potential, this woman, this, you know, non-binary person to hold their space as well.
Right. What about the fact that you earlier mentioned that simple thing like saying batsman versus saying batter, right? Can you share any wins, so to speak, or any changes which you were able to make by your being a woman commentator in the entire pool?
A young girl went into a cricket store, and I heard this a lot, but wasn't commentating at the time, so could never really shift things. Maybe this is why it is so important to me, but a young girl went into a, wrote a letter to Kookaburra cricket equipment. So Kookaburra is one of the major suppliers of bats and pads and protective equipment in the game. She went into the store to buy some cricket equipment for her to wear as a girl, and she said there was nothing for me to buy because when she looked at the terminology on all the equipment, it was boys. The sizing was boys and men. And she said there was nothing for girls and women. And so in her mind, the game of cricket wasn't for girls and women. It was just for boys and men, because they'd never really thought about it, because that terminology had been in since day dot. So they actually now have changed all their terminology for the sizing of the equipment to youth. And just that little simple change, I think a lot of that has stemmed from the fact that we're trying to be a little bit more gender neutral on the commentary, is that it makes people question other sorts of things. And that makes a massive difference, because that sense of belonging that we've spoken about, and if young girls don't feel as if they belong in the sport of cricket, they'll go off and play another sport.
Mm. So did you encounter any racial discrimination during your journey in cricket or now as a commentator? I recently read about the ICEC report in London, right, which highlighted the prevalence of institutional racism, sexism and class-based discrimination in the English game. So do you think these issues, you know, still persist?
Yep, daily, without a doubt. I think we're more cognizant of them, but I think what we're still grappling with within sport, within cricket, within society, is the acknowledgement that it's still in the systems. It's institutionalized over, you know, centuries. This is a hard thing to crack. So I think, you know, people will say, you know, I often hear from Australians, oh, Australia isn't a racist country, but that's coming from a white person in Australia. They don't stop and say, do you think Australia is a racist country? And I don't think they ask that, because I don't think they're not going to like the answer. And not just Australia, a lot of countries I go to struggling with racism, whether it's a blatant racist call straight to your face or whether it is just the way in which people behave. But I would get once a week, once a fortnight, people coming up to me saying, oh, you lucky thing, you've been on a holiday, you've got a great tan. They don't see me as a woman of colour. And whether that's how I speak or how I present myself, but they don't see me as a woman of colour, which is I clearly am. And if I could read out the direct messages I got on my Instagram and Twitter feeds, they were horrendous. And it was all, so much of it was based on colour, to the point where I actually had to bring my mum up and tell her maybe not go down to the main street of the country town where she lived and things like that. Like, it got to that point, and it got to the point where I actually had Victorian police contact Cricket Australia and say, we've got someone who is threatening Mel to a point where she needs to get off social media because we're concerned for her safety, kind of thing. And I could have taken that to court. So, you know, it elevate to that level very, very quickly. And so then your life changes straight away. You know, you're not being your genuine happy out for yourself because you're concerned about people knowing where you live, how that affects your immediate family and your friends. You can't just be in the moment. It's something you need to protect yourself in and be aware of, because it's draining to deal with that piece. It gets to a point sometimes where you're the only person of color in the room having to always fight and get people to understand all the time. And it can really drag you down, because you're fighting all the time. And I hate to say I'm a lover, I'm not a fighter, but you feel as if you're always having to front up and be the person to try and get people to understand.
This needs a lot of mental strength. So what's the toolkit which keeps you going?
Yeah, the toolkit is expanding quite a bit. Look, I think at the end of the day, if you protect yourself and give yourself the energy to front up when you can, you're hopefully making it easier and better for people. But where they don't have to worry about this as much, I think I'm happy to invest in that, because I've been so, so fortunate. I hate to say I'm lucky, because I think at the end of the day, you create your own luck. So I've invested in being curious. I've invested in a uni degree or education and conversations with people that I don't agree with. So yeah, the more time you invest in those sorts of things, I think allows you the chance to benefit from opportunities. So it's not a luck thing. I don't know. I think it's back to my mum and my dad and my friends who are happy, healthy people. And that part of that is privilege of just the space in which we're born in. And a lot of people don't have that. So if I can help make other people's lives a little bit easier, I'm happy to do so.
You're literally willing to take all this BS, for lack of a better word, just so that you can leave the world a better place for your having lived.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to sound like I'm altruistic and, you know, the shining beacon or anything along those lines, because I don't think I am. But yeah, I think there is something nice about the world. I've mentioned to you when we caught up before is that, what are your values in life? And, you know, someone asked me once and I went, I actually don't know. So I asked my mum what her values were. And she went, oh, and she did exactly the same. So we actually spent a bit of time apart. We came back together again and she wrote me this beautiful letter. I was never one that wanted to get a tattoo by any stretch of the imagination, because I never was passionate enough about something. But I realized that if I ever did, it would be something around my mum. And what I did, her values, I wanted to get in a tattoo, and I have that tattoo on my ankle. She came up with respect, balance, love and hope. And I've still got the letter of where she actually describes and breaks down each one of those four values. And it's not like I've stolen my mum's values, but they resonate with me daily. So if I'm confronted with, you know, a challenging situation or got to decide on one thing or the other or things like that, I come back to those four things to try and give me a grounding point, a starting point for making decisions in life.
That's beautiful. I can only visualize how she must have spoken to you. It just all sounds really heartwarming. Yeah.
Yeah. They might change. Oh, I'm not too sure. You know, you go through life and you shift and you learn other things. But I think as a starting point, they're four pretty good values to have.
You know, I'd love to hear what's consuming you now and what's keeping you occupied.
So my cycle sort of goes Australian summer into the Women's Premier League, which is the equivalent of the IPL in India now, which started up this year, which is a magnificent event and will change the sort of the space of women's sport and cricket exponentially over the next few years. So there's a month or so in India, sort of Feb, March, potentially some IPL. Then I go to England for 2 to 3 months and work with Sky Cricket across their summer as well. And then there might be a World Cup on. So we've got Women's T20 World Cup in Bangladesh coming up next year. And then the Men's T20 World Cup in the US and the West Indies in June as well. And then there's two businesses that I've started with friends. One, Game On, is looking at the untold stories of women's sport, where we'll be producing documentaries. And hopefully, fingers crossed, some time spent in India will mean that we're bringing out some wonderful documentaries of women's sport in India across cricket and a variety of other ones. I've been heavily involved with the Afghanistan women's cricket team that we got out post the Taliban takeover in 2020. So we've sort of got that going. And then a company with two other mates. It's an educational platform, really, but based on tours for women that work in sport and business. But we use sport as the backdrop to elevate their skill set there as well. And then all your charity work. So, yeah, we'll always work with Red Dust and do what I can to help their work in remote communities in Australia across health promotion.
So, Mel, we have more than established that sports is a wonderful platform for women to learn these skills. So do share your parting thoughts for aspiring leaders as they transition into larger roles.
First thing I would say to people is get out of your bubble. So it might be your own sport. It might be your own political thoughts. It could be a variety of different things, but we get in there because we feel safe and heard and probably not challenged as much. So I think be a little bit brave and get outside of your own bubbles just to challenge your own thoughts a little bit, which probably leads into the other piece for me is see other people's perspectives. The world is a very large, wonderful place, and there are so many different ways of looking at the same issue or problem or solution or situation. And the more we can sort of see it from a different angle, I think the better we are at making decisions, because we've covered everything off and we don't get down the track and we think, oh, I didn't think of that. Think of everything. Try and think of as many different things as possible. And that means getting out of your bubble, speaking to different people and listening. Listen, listen, listen. And I think the last thing is rest and rejuvenation. You can't take things on and be present without having your batteries full and a full energy level. And that takes a commitment to saying no to things and saying yes to doing things that are important for you, to take time to rest. And that's mind, body, soul, all three covered off as well.
Thank you very much for sharing your insights, your mother's values, and giving so many different perspectives to one journey.
Emma, thank you so much. I think sometimes when you don't really think about it till you talk it out loud a little bit. So it's actually sparked a few things for me to go along and jot down and explore a little bit more as well, which is lovely.
Oh, great. Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.